It's a pleasure to be here, and it's always a pleasure to come back to Madison, where, of course, Savage Love got started in the back room of Four Star Fiction and Video, where a few things got started while I was there. I've been writing Savage Love for 23 years, which is a very long time. I gave your parents, many of you, blowjob advice back in the day. Thank God your moms did more than swallow, or you would not be with us tonight. But working in a Q&A format that long really carves the Q&A groove very deeply in your non-existent soul. So I much prefer to get to the Q&A as quickly as possible. But I'm going to say just a few things about my experiences with free thinking and the trouble that it got me into. I grew up Catholic on the north side of Chicago. I assume this being Wisconsin, but I am not the only Catholic, recovered or otherwise, in the room. Unlike my siblings, though, I had two brothers and a sister, I believed it. I really fell for it. I bought it. I fell hard. My dad was a Catholic deacon. My mom was a Catholic lay minister. I had aunts who were nuns. My grandfather was a high poobah in the Knights of Columbus. We went to church every Sunday, and I went to a seminary for high school, a preparatory seminary. The Catholics, they always like to get you nice and young in every sense of that expression. And they were reeling me in, and, you know, I was 13 when I arrived at the seminary, and then I hit puberty. And hitting puberty, realizing you're gay your first year in an all-boys Catholic seminary, is a little bit like realizing you're an alcoholic at your first day at the Budweiser bottling plant. It was a little awkward. And really, you know, my sexuality did bring me into conflict with what I was being told by my church, which also told me that it was always right about everything. Don't bring up Galileo, please. They hated that. But I got in trouble even before my sexuality brought me into conflict with my church, with my faith, and what I've been taught to believe. Even when I was a little, like, monstery brat in grade school, I was so obnoxious. I did the thing that the Catholic Church burnt people at the stake for 500 years ago. I read the Bible. The Catholic Church burnt people at the stake for translating the Bible into the vernacular back in the day. And I read it, and I would get into arguments with priests who taught our religion classes at St. Jerome's about whether women should be priests, because it seemed to me quite obvious from any cursory reading of the Gospels, I would say, precociously, in grade six, that although there were no female disciples that made it through the final edit, the first two people to whom Jesus manifested himself after the resurrection were Mary and Mary, Mary Magdalene and his mother Mary. They were the first people to preach the good news of the risen Lord. That's how I talked to them. We talk about and the first people to disbelieve this news were the disciples, were men. So, because so much of the Bible is this inscrutable parabolathon, and we're supposed to infer and interpret and read into this massive trick question that is life itself, as presented to us by our Catholic God, it seems to me that the answer to the trick question, should women be priests, was evidently answered by Jesus himself, who the first priests were indeed women. And I would say that to priests and get yelled at. Also to my dad, the Catholic deacon, once I was home alone as a very small child, I think I was 6 or 7, looking at one of those illustrated encyclopedias for children. And I found a procession up a Mayan temple, up a Mayan pyramid. And I was looking at this, I was like 7 years old, I'm looking at this, I just had my first communion, looking at this going, you know, there are these priests in these feathered robes, and there are people carrying sacred objects in this long procession down this aisle. And I looked at it and went, that looks like Mass. And I took it to my dad and went, that looks like Mass. And he said, yes, but they were wrong. And I said, how do you know that? Because I have faith. And I was like, well, but they did too. And that was sort of the beginning of the end, even at age 7. But it really wasn't until what I wanted to do with my dick, or what I wanted to do with my dick, brought me into conflict with the church that I really had to think about it. And some people I know who are queer and Catholic will be brought into conflict with the church because every sperm is sacred and we're putting sperms in unsacred spots. And they'll do this thing that I've never understood. They'll go find a church that isn't wrong about them, instead of thinking what I did at age 13, well, if they're wrong about me, if they're wrong about sexuality, because I couldn't see what could possibly be wrong with gay sex. No one was getting hurt. And love is love. Like, even then, like, love is love, and I want to kiss boys, and what the fuck's wrong with that? Instead of thinking, oh, I just need to go out and search and find a church, find a faith that isn't wrong about my sexuality, I started thinking, well, if they're wrong about sexuality, what else are they wrong about? And that is a thread that when you're gay and you're sort of brought into conflict with the faith and tradition in which you're raised, when you start pulling that thread, the entire garment unravels, and unravels quickly. And I was so grateful. I mean, then I was so terrorized or tormented and upset. But I'm so grateful now that it was sex that brought me, that prompted me to think freely. Because sex is the obvious obsession of the three great desert monotheisms, right? And if you start thinking, well, why this obsession with sex? What is it about? And ultimately, it's about control. Because if you can convince someone that their desires are sinful, if you can convince someone that their desires make God puke, if you can convince someone that their longings, most intimate thoughts, the way they express love, or the way they seek release is going to get them damned for all eternity and cast into a lake of fire where they will be tormented for all eternity, you've really got them. And if you're the only person they can go to, the only institution that they can go to because you have taught them this, for intercession, if you're the only arbiter that can plead their case, if you're the only gumball machine where they can get the magic gumball that forgives their sins and wipes them clean, you can control those people. And that's why it's always sex. Islam, sex. Christianity, sex. Judaism, sex. Why it's regulated. To control. And not just control the gays, but control women particularly, but also men, to terrorize all of us about our sexualities and our desires. Because if you can terrorize people about that, you've got them. You know, they also do dietary stuff, but that's easy. Don't eat pork. All right. Whatever. There's turkey bacon now. We're good. But if you can get them sexually, you've got them, and you've got them for life, particularly if they buy it and they believe it. And they present to us all of the big sort of crazy sex-negative faiths from Mormonism. They've presented to us this warped misconception of human sexuality, which in a way is, I guess, charming. Not at all. I'm being sarcastic. This warped idea of what human sexuality is for. You know, Sam Harris, in his book, Letter to a Christian Nation, as I've gotten into great amounts of trouble mentioning in front of audiences full of high school students, points out that the Bible got slavery wrong. He calls it the easiest moral question that humanity ever faced, and the Bible got it wrong. The Bible is a pro-slavery document. The Bible was on the side of the slave owners, and they were very clear about that during the Civil War. And so if the Bible got slavery wrong, what else did the Bible got wrong? Well, if the Bible got the most obvious moral question humanity's ever faced wrong, what are the chances the Bible got something as complicated and mysterious to people hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, as human sexuality wrong? About 100,000% is my rough estimate. And they continue to get it wrong. When you look in our culture, you know, Australia got the convicts and Canada got the French and we got the Puritans. If you just look in our culture at the things social conservatives, religious conservatives, and the Republican Party obsess about, it is sex. All of them are sex, the social issues that they prefer to talk about because they cannot win an economic issues argument, so they want to talk about what? They want to talk about birth control pills, and they want to talk about abortion, and they want to talk about gay marriage. The one thing that all of these things have in common is sex for pleasure. Is that someone is having sex not intending to make a baby. As Rick Santorum said, you're doing that which is wrong, that we know to be wrong, because sex has one purpose, which is procreation, according to Rick Santorum. That was God's intent, which is why human females go into heat like cats, and that's the only time you can them. This is another trick question laid at our feet by our loving comic Joker God. You're only supposed to do it this one way, but I'm going to desire you to do it every which way and want to do it every which way. And then if you haven't gotten the priest's blessing after, then you go to hell. But just see, so when you talk, anyway, this is where I say, I need a question, next question. When you talk about human sexuality, it is still all of these social issues that we debate so ferociously in this country, in our culture, it's still about this inability of so many people, because of the faiths in which they were raised, to reconcile themselves to what human sexuality is about and for. And it is about and for pleasure. It has been estimated that humans have 1,000 sexual contacts for every single live birth. What's sex for? Those babies? Yeah, one out of every 1,000 times. Sex is obviously fulfilling some other role in the lives of all of us as individuals, but also in our cultures and our societies. Sex is doing other things, providing pleasure, release, creating intimacy, creating partner bonds, or triad bonds, or quaddy bonds. Sex does all of this and more, and that is a feature, not a bug. And faith traditions that people were making up, back when we didn't know why the sun came up every day, surprise, it's back. And they had to explain that away. They wanted to explain and regulate human sexuality, and I do believe that humans need some regulation of their sexual impulses and desires and behaviors, but it needs to come from inside, from a moral framework that is not tied to faithy hoo-ha, because sex is dangerous and powerful, and we have to be thoughtful as we approach it. And I smoke a lot of pot. So I completely forgot where I was going. Anybody want to remind me? Jamie Kilston, probably get me off the sauce. Can we just do questions now, or I'm just going to, like, lose myself? Anyway, awesome. This is where I was going. It is my fond hope, as we continue to have this conversation about sex and sexuality that's really brand new. We've only just discovered the rest of the clitoris in the last 15 years. We weren't aware of the rest of it. We've only really just, in the last half century, begun to study human sexuality in a serious and scientifically sound way. But as we come to understand human sexuality better, I'm hoping that we can decouple it from religious superstition, fear it less, enjoy it more, and allow it to be as meaningful and important and powerful and transcendent, which is the secular word for spiritual, as it can be, and as it should be. And we might as well enjoy it, because we can't escape it, unless we're asexual, in which case, good for you, you win. All right, let's do some questions. This is why I work in a Q&A format. I can't just give a speech and talk. I need, like, the back and forth. I need the play.
So you alluded to this a little bit. In 2012, you took a little bit of heat for telling a group of high school students that you can learn to ignore the bullet in the Bible about gay people. You want to tell us about that?
I spoke at the National Conference of High School Journalists, 3,000 high school students, juniors and seniors, in a convention center in Seattle. And when I got there, I was like, do you want me to pull any punches? Do you want me to, like, dial it back? And they're like, no, don't patronize them. Speak to them as if they are adults, because indeed they are. And I said that there was, you know, when I was talking about bullying, I was talking about the It Gets Better Project, and you have these people who run around saying they can't help but bully queer teenagers because, you know, it says right here in the Bible. But we ignore all sorts of other things that are right there in the Bible. We pretend they're not even there. We pretend, you tell people that the Bible is pro-slavery, and they don't believe you. Christians, who allegedly read the Bible all the time, insist that is not so, and you have to read to them to win the argument. And I said, you know, we've learned to ignore the bullet in the Bible about menstruation and seafood and farming and clothing and slavery. And we can learn to ignore the bullshit in the Bible about us, too. We're not asking, queer people are not asking Christians to do anything that they already haven't done, which is let go of that, to acknowledge that the Bible got human sexuality wrong, gay people wrong, just like it got slavery wrong.
But I said bullshit in the Bible.
Which you're not allowed to do. There's this wonderful Mark Twain quote where he said the Bible has some gory ancient history, some beautiful parables, some this, some that, and upwards of 1,000 lies, which is 19th century for bullshit. Right? No, this is not a new idea that there's bullshit in the Bible. But I said it in front of 3,000 high school students, and 22 of them walked out, which on Fox News became a mass walkout. On Fox News became I was speaking at a Christian high school, that I had somehow like seized control of this conference, and like, I'm the devil. You have to invite me to come. I don't just show up. And it was very instructive. I reach out to people sometimes when they're in that Fox News crosshairs where they're just being demagogued about, and it really does blow up your email, it blows up your Twitter feed. You have a million drooling psychos coming at you all at once, and it can really make you feel panicked. And I always tell people, it burns hot, it burns fast. If any of you ever are in that position that I was in, where I was just being like screamed at on Fox News and the Sunday talk shows and these columnists, Breitbart, just turn off your computer, get stoned, go to the movies, wait a couple of days, and they will be on to the next outrage-a-thon. And then you can open your email and you can count all the emails from people with AOL addresses. And think, haha.
How do we deal with biblical fundamentalists who think that being gay is literally an abomination?
How do we deal with them? Well, you know, we can't... One of the things that I've typically tried to avoid doing, although, you know, bullshit in the Bible, sometimes we have to argue with them about their theology, taking their theology as the frame, right? You have to sometimes argue with religious people, accepting that their framework, accepting their premises, right? But I think it's really sometimes very good for secular folks, for leftists, for queers, to say to people, I am going to hell. I will concede that. You know, religious fundamentalist, right-wing fundamentalist, Bible-beating Christian, I am going to hell with the Jews and the yoga instructors and the Catholics if you're a Lutheran, and the Lutherans if you're a Catholic. The world is full of people who are going to hell, according to you, but why do we come in for this very special attention and persecution here on earth? All we queers want is the same deal the Jews have now. Not historically, but now. There are no pogroms now. Can we not have that? And then you can content yourself with the idea that I will be roasting on a spit in hell for all eternity, being tortured only by female devils, lest I get off on it if it's a dicked devil. And it can sometimes be very freeing for someone just to say, yeah, to remind them that you're entitled to your private religious beliefs. All we're saying is that your private religious beliefs and bigotries can no longer have force of law. That doesn't strip you of your private little sandbox religious beliefs. You can believe whatever you want to believe, but I shouldn't have my rights curtailed in this life because you think that your imaginary friend hates me. I can invent an imaginary friend who hates you. And then where are we? So we have to agree to disagree about what our imaginary friends think is icky. And so sometimes that's the best tack. Like, you can, there are persuadables that you can argue about religion, you can argue about theology. So many people have changed their minds in the last 30, 40 years on this issue. It's not because all the people who were homophobic 30, 40 years ago died and have been replaced, although that has happened too in many cases. But no, many people have come around. So I think the trick in your own life is to identify the people who are reasonable and reason with them, and then just let it go. The unreasonable psychos say, yes, going to hell. Isn't that enough? Why do you have to punish me here on earth? It's almost as if you don't believe God is going to punish me in the afterlife. Let God take care of it.
So there's a correlation between the experiences of people who come out as non-religious to their families and their friends and the people who come out in the LGBT movement. What can we do to encourage those people to come out and also support them while they're doing it?
It's all about community, and it's all about identifying Armistead Maupin, if you want to borrow something from Gayland, in one of his early Tales of the City books, wrote this beautiful phrase, there's your biological family, and there's your logical family. And sometimes there's overlap. Sometimes there's a nice Venn diagram, and there's a whole bunch of people in your biological family who are also a part of your logical family. So you have to identify the people in your logical family. You have to create your own community, create your own families. And if there's one thing that that I'm constantly telling young LGBT people who are coming out to do that's very effective. People put this into practice. It works. And if you're in this position with your family because you're coming out as a non-believer and they're freaking out, this is what you do. Don't fear their rejection. Make them fear yours. Shift it. Your leverage over your parents as an adult child is your presence in their lives. If they cannot respect you, do not be present in their lives. Demand respect and unconditional love as a condition of your presence, not a condition of your love. You love them still, but you will not subject yourself to abuse. Period, the end. And queer kids do this. I talk to queer kids who are doing this now. I say, give your family a year to freak out, to ask ugly, stupid questions, to have their tantrum, and at the end of that year be, I'm not coming home for Christmas if Christmas is going to be an argument about my sexuality. That's over. I'm not coming home for Christmas if Christmas is going to be an argument about the baby Jesus. That's over. Really, it's all about shifting the terror dome, right? Look at them and say, who's going to change your diapers in 20 years if you keep this up, because it ain't going to be me.
So, to the best of my knowledge, you've added two words to the English language, pegging and Santorum. You want to give us a little background? Pegging and Santorum?
Pegging is a woman, a man in the ass with a strap-on dildo, which was a very popular kind of kink that people had just begun to explore in the early 90s, but every time it was written about in my column, they would have to use this like 40-syllable sentence. I'm a straight guy, but I'm interested in getting in the ass by a woman with a strap-on dildo, and it was just so long, and we have word counts in columns. We have to condense things. So I asked my readers to invent a new a term for this, and they all sent in suggested new definitions, and pegging won. A woman cannot peg another woman. Lesbians can't peg. Pegging is all about that sort of gender role inversion craziness of her and him, which is still straight sex, guys, if you're interested, but terrified. If a woman is doing it to a man, it's straight sex, no matter who's getting penetrated at any particular moment. And it's worked. Now, this is the accepted term. It hasn't made the Oxford English Dictionary yet, but it will. And Santorum, of course, I've been sort of curating this salon with my readers for so long. I didn't come up with the term pegging. I just identified a need and threw it out there to my readers and crowdsourced it before people were using the internet to crowdsource. And same thing with Santorum. Rick Santorum gave this terrible, read my book, American Savage, I unpack this at length. Rick Santorum in 2003 gave this interview, famously, where he compared married or gay couples, no, non-married at the time, who wished to marry to people who rape children and dogs. Man on child, man on dog, two dudes who want to marry. And a reader wrote and said, let's never, and the scandal blew up, and it was, people talked about it for a few days, for a couple weeks. George Bush came out and said that Rick Santorum's a good man who loves people in his heart. Doesn't love people in his brain or his mouth ever, but. And a reader very presciently wrote me and said, we can't let this ever be forgotten. We should rename a gay sex act Santorum so this will always be remembered. And I threw that out there to my readers, and they all like responded, and we put 10 different definitions proposed in the column that came from readers, and readers selected as the new definition for Santorum the frothy mix of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes the byproduct of anal sex.
And then that came up in Google searches more often than Santorum himself. that definition came up in Google searches more often than Rick Santorum himself.
It was the number one Google return for Rick Santorum or Santorum for a decade. If you Googled Santorum, the first thing that popped up was our website, spreadingsantorum.com, which included on the Google's front page the whole entire definition. And when Santorum started to run for president in 2012, there were all these articles written about his Google problem. He has a Google problem. You know, somebody sees this guy in a debate, they go, I'm going to find his website so I can give him some money. And they Google him, and up pops the frothy mix of loop and fecal matter. So my God, and on the first page, like, then there was, like, the wiki site about the neo-dualism campaign. There were the Urban Dictionary definition page for Santorum. Like, most of the results, including ours first, were this. And here's what happened when he ran for president in 2011-12. There were a million stories written about his Google problem where they had to then talk about the AP interview where he compared gay couples to dog and child rapists. So it worked. That reader's idea that if we could successfully tag him, we could successfully appropriate his name and make it mean something horrible, that this interview could never be buried or forgotten, absolutely came true. Every story written about it, Wall Street Journal, conservative magazines, Mother Jones, the New York Times, they all had to unpack that interview over and over and over again in 2011. And they will have to when he runs for president in 2016, which he is going to do.
All right. Saddlebacking.
And saddlebacking. Saddlebacking is when Christians have anal sex so they to preserve their virginities, which is a thing. If you've had nothing but lousy sex education that says virginity is a vagina that's never had a penis in it, then every other orifice and pore is fair game. And diamondbacking, of course, is agreeing to have anal sex if he'll propose. Which are all riffs on barebacking, which is condomless anal sex.
Based on your experience in the atheist movement, how welcoming are atheist groups to LGBT people? What can we do better?
To make atheist groups more welcoming of LGBT people? I think they're plenty welcoming. I've never sensed from any atheist organization or even person I've ever talked to any hostility towards queer people. You know, there are prejudices that sort of, anti-queer prejudices that slosh around in the culture. Any organization of humans are going to have some sort of residual biases that have to be confronted or ID'd, or whether you're talking about any room with a lot of white people in it, any room with a lot of straight people in it. So we should be on our guard at all times, but I think we shouldn't freak out unnecessarily at well-intentioned people who put a foot wrong. Because that's how you dissolve movements and drive people away. That's not how you build them.
Over the last 60 or so years, we've seen major cultural strides taken in racial equality, gender equality, LGBT equality, and civil rights in general. Do you think we're approaching a golden age of equality? And do you think we'll ever have a true equality?
We will never have true equality, because we are just monkeys in shoes, as Tim mentioned, Freethinker sings. You know, there's always progress and there's always regress. You know, the tide goes in, the tide goes out. Christopher Isherwood said social tolerance and justice can reach a high water mark like the tide and then recede out of sight. It was illegal to kill Jews in Germany in 1922, and not so much 20 years later. So we can't be blasé about the progress we've made. But as lefties, and I assume most of us here are lefties, the right wing has a myth that they constantly hammer away at, that any social progress is too risky, that we can't risk allowing LGBT people, or LGB, trans people still can't serve openly in the military, but we can't risk letting gay people serve openly in the military because, oh my God, the sky will fall, right? They made the same arguments about giving women the vote. They made the same argument about doing away with Jim Crow laws, letting African Americans vote. They're still kind of not so into the African Americans voting thing. And you see that on the conservative side all the time. The myth is, their myth is, we can't risk any progress. It's too dangerous and destabilizing. The left wing has its own myth, which is there's been no progress. That we are just as racist, just as sexist, just as homophobic, just as transphobic, a culture and a society as we have ever been. And that's bullshit. We have made tremendous progress, and as lefties, we should constantly be pointing to the progress that we have made because it destroys their argument that we can't risk progress. Just on the LGBT just on Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a great recent example. They predicted that if we did away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell and allowed queer people to serve openly in the military, that they said that 500,000 troops were prepared to quit the military, that 500,000 people were going to leave the military because they would not serve with openly gay, lesbian, or bi people. Two people quit. Both chaplains. Not exactly crucial to the war effort. And we should hang that around their necks. So whenever anybody says, you know, when something terrible happens, when Matthew Shepard was murdered, a lot of people had this gut with Prop 8, but everybody had a terrible reaction to Prop 8 passed. A lot of people had terrible reactions to Matthew Shepard's murder and said, look, there's been no progress. The state of Wyoming, and this is 20 years ago, state of Wyoming prosecuted Matthew Shepard's murderers with the same ferocity that they would have prosecuted two dudes who murdered a nun. They brought them up on capital charges. They tried to get the death penalty. 20 years before that, they would have said, he hit on me and been acquitted. So even in a horrifying story, even in a horrifying reality, even a horrifying moment like the murder of Matthew Shepard, you can detect a threat of progress, as perverse as that may sound. And we as lefties should always be identifying those threads of progress and celebrating them and putting focus and attention on them, not to cover up the places where we still need to make progress or things that are still up, but to justify working on those things that are up, because it will not destroy the culture or the society or bring down the republic.
Yeah, along the same lines, we've seen more and more people come out in gay area, or as gay in areas of culture that have traditionally been opposed. Jason Collins and Michael Sam recently came out as openly gay men in professional sports, the first to do it in their respective sports. What do you think this says about the changing cultural sentiment to LGBT people?
Because hairdressers and cross-dressers and trans people and bull dykes and effeminate, crazy waiters couldn't hide 50 years ago and 40 years ago and decided to get up off the ground and start fighting. All those outcasts and queers made it safe for basketball players to come out and football players to come out. And I'm thrilled about it. I really am thrilled about it. I'm not disparaging what Jason Collins has done. Jason Collins has been amazing. But no hairdresser on the front lines at Stonewall screaming his lungs out, no Jason Collins 50 years later or 40 years later.
You recently wrote and released a new book titled American Savage. You want to give us a little background?
American Savage is sort of this, if you read the column, if you listen to the podcast, it's a lot of the ideas that I talk about all the time about monogamy, about politics, about healthcare, about a whole bunch of different things, about end-of-life decisions, about sex, about kink, about GGG, sort of big chapters dedicated to all these things that have sort of risen up, including Rick Santorum, things that I've been toying with in my column and my podcast for a long time, throwing a lasso around these big issues, big ideas, and presenting them in one big, fat, stupid book. It's got a lot of, you know, ass jokes in it, so you should read it. Politics goes better. Social commentary goes down easier with an ass joke or two.
What would you say the main point of your book is? Are you advocating for cultural change? Or?
You know, I think the biggest chapters in the book are on being GGG, decentering monogamy as a definitional sort of default setting for relationships and making it opt-in, and being thoughtful about relationships. And also, you know, the gay, I pound the religious haters. You know, one of the things I write about in the book is, you know, how we respond to that. It's a choice argument. And my, this whole chapter in the book, when somebody says it's a choice, you look at them and say, choose it. Suck my dick. Like, right now, if you believe there's a switch in your head that you can flip that turns you from not gay to gay, flip it. And I will use my camera phone and I will videotape you and we'll put it on XTube and you will win the argument. It's the only sort of irrational, rational response to that. And that's what I love to do with my writing sometimes, is just to take them, to take their premise and accept it and run with it. Like, okay, it's a choice, choose it. And that's one of the chapters in the book I'm proudest of. It's addressed to Herman Cain. Suck my dick, Herman Cain.
You and your husband, Terry, have one adopted son. I believe it's DJ?
Yeah.
You've said in the past that he has had to come out to you as straight. What was that experience like?
Our son, who is now 16, and shh, nobody tweet about this. He doesn't like me to talk about him in public anymore because he's 16. Although he's fine with me talking about this, because if you have gay parents and you're straight, you want them to mention it at every opportunity. But he came out to us as straight, and it was weird because all of his life, earlier in his life, he had insisted that he was gay, that he would be gay when he grew up. He really wanted to be gay. At 9, we had this conflict with some neighbor. Not really conflict. We moved into a new neighborhood, and DJ went out one day with his little friend, and they were rude to some girls in the neighborhood. And our block is like all girls. It's a matriarchy. It's all little girls. And he was like, they were shitty to these little girls. And one, it's Seattle. There's a knock on the door, and there's a Seattle mom letting us know, just so that, you know, we're all clear, and you're like, we can meet. And she ends this, we're like, oh God, we're so sorry, we'll talk to him. And she ended it with, I just think that, you know, DJ has issues with women, and you need to look to that. And I was like, DJ's issue with girls is that he's a 9-year-old boy. He hates girls. Like, there's no issues with women. And, the sort of passive-aggressive insinuation was, of course, in your all-male gay fag household, he's got girl issues. And so we sat DJ down, and we're just like, you know, you're 9, puberty's coming for you, we're pretty sure you're going to be straight, just in case. You may want, now that the stakes are really low, to just have conversations with girls every once in a while. So that when you want to have conversations with girls in 4 years, it's not so terrifying and fraught. Like, do it now. And you have to be nice to the neighborhood girls, you can't be you don't have to play with them, you don't want to, but talk to them and don't be a dick. And his response was, I'm gay, I'm going to be gay when I grow up. I hate girls, that means I'm gay like you. And we went and got Terry's photo albums, because Terry's mom was a shutterbug, he's all these photo albums. We went and got Terry's photo albums, which were like open to Terry, my husband's 9th birthday party. And it's him at a big table surrounded by 12 girls. We were like, you know what? Not liking girls at your age means you're going to be straight. Liking girls at your age, like Terry did, means you're going to be gay. But he sort of doubled down on this, like, I'm going to be gay. So it was a little awkward for him. He decided, you know, he had to finally tell us that he was straight. And, it's, you know, I pivot in that chapter to an argument with Tony Perkins, who's the head of the Family Research Council. Who's back. he once threatened to sue me because I said Tony Perkins sits on a pile of dead gay children at work every day. And he sends people, maybe it's you, he sends people to tape me at events in case I say things like that, so that he can threaten to sue me. So if you're here from the Family Research Council and you dyed your hair as a disguise, that's great. Oh, good. But I'll say it again, right into your camera, just in case. Tony Perkins sits on a pile of dead gay children in the day of work. And the reason, I have to unpack that a little bit, the reason I say that is, Tony Perkins encourages people to reject their gay children, to be hostile to them. And that hostility, research has shown, doubles a child's already quadrupled risk for suicide if they're queer. Tony Perkins tells parents to do what Tony Perkins knows, doubles this already quadrupled risk for suicide, and then points to the suicide rate among gay youth as proof that the gay lifestyle is dangerous and unhealthy because look at all these kids committing suicide. But Tony Perkins also argues that what makes kids gay is bad parenting, and what makes kids gay, and that gay people by adopting, we're going to make our kids gay, we're going to raise them in this gay environment, and our kids are going to be gay. And I point out in this chapter, if my son didn't turn out gay, living with the gayest people on earth, like we are the Ringling Brothers' gayest show on earth at our house. We listen to musicals. There's photos on me on the wall in drag. Terry goes out to DJ in leather. Like, we're gay. And if it's not catching, if it is catching, this kid would have caught it. If it was contagious, this kid growing up in our house would be gay, and he is not. So Tony Perkins wrong about that, too.
You wrote a memoir titled The Kid, I believe it was 1999. Yeah. So 15 years later, reflect on that. Has anything changed? Or I'm sure that it has. What has changed?
A lot has changed since we adopted DJ. Terry and I were, sort of among the first gay male couples to adopt as gay male couples. It's funny, when DJ was an infant, people would meet us and assume that we had adopted together. And when DJ got to be about 10, people would meet us as a family and assume that one of us had had a child in a previous heterosexual relationship. Because gay men didn't have kids who were as old as DJ is. We were the first male couple that went through our adoption agency. We did an open adoption, which is where the birth mother chooses the family that the child is placed with. And they had never done a placement for a gay male couple before. And we went in to these meetings and it's so clear that they didn't know what to do with gay people. The very first day of the seminar at the adoption agency, you had to sit around a big table, we did, with six other couples, and we had to all go around the table and share our infertility stories. And, like, it's getting closer and closer to us, and I'm like, I keep inseminating him and nothing. So they're a bit more sensitive to that now, and now they do a lot of placements. You know, the irony was they told us it might take 5 years. They told us we would be in for a 5-year wait. And we thought, okay, well, we've only been together 2 years, and, you know, let's just fill out all the paperwork, get it in, and then 5 years from now, if we're still together, then clearly we're gonna be together forever and we'll have the kid. So we get all the paperwork in, and 9 weeks later we had a baby. And we're still together, so it worked out. But a lot has changed, and I really do think that the queer people parenting, whether they were queer people who had kids in past heterosexual relationships, which is the majority of queer parents. Per capita, the state with the most same-sex couples raising kids, not California, not Washington State, not New York, Mississippi. The biggest creator of gay households, of gay parent-headed families, is not MSNBC. It is religious conservatism. Most people who are queer who have kids had kids in heterosexual relationships that they entered into because they didn't think that they could ever come out. And then they get married early, they can't stay closeted anymore, they divorce and they find a same-sex partner and become parents together. Anyway, I forgot what I was talking about. 5 years. Oh, but one of the things I think that the gay parenting movement, the existence of gay parents did, is it really gave the lie to the anti-marriage crowd. And they always want the argument to be about kids and how kids are doing in our households. And our kids are fine. Every study save the Mark Regeneres, now completely discredited and debunked study, shows our kids are just as happy, healthy, and well-adjusted on average as anybody who's straight's kids would be. And the existence of our kids as a fact on the ground made demagoguing about gay families almost impossible, and helped, I think, really drive the marriage movement in a positive way.
Last question before we get into your guys' questions. What is your opinion of the recent appraisal for Pope Francis for his discussion of LGBTQ people?
Do you guys know what's going on in Uganda? Yeah. Uganda has passed vicious anti-gay legislation. The death penalty, I think, is not part of it right now, but throwing people in jail, there's really an anti-gay program going on in Uganda. Uganda's a majority Catholic country, and the original sponsor of this legislation is a Catholic woman. If the Pope meant what he said about de-emphasizing these issues, where is the excommunication threat? Where is the Pope leveraging his power to protect these vulnerable queer Ugandans, almost all of them Catholic queer Ugandans, from this violence, this state-sponsored violence? So I am not impressed. The rhetorical shift is valuable. I think it's important. If we can all agree to disagree about whether I'm going to hell or not and work on social justice issues and economic justice issues, fun. But there was a, you know, put up or shut up moment in Uganda, and the church shut up. So I'm not that impressed. I am impressed. There were the Pope sent the top prelates, the top cardinals and bishops in the United States, to the U.S.-Mexican border, to the horrible fence, and had them say mass on the fence, at the fence, and push past communion wafers through the fence to outreached hands. And symbolically, it was beautiful. It was a true sort of the Pope using it, or the church using its moral authority and the spotlight that it can create to highlight a terrible injustice. So I was very pleased by that. I was thrilled by that. I wrote about it, praised it. But when it comes to LGBT issues, I don't think that they mean it. And I think that Uganda proves that they don't mean it.
Sorry about the music next door, guys.
It's a production of Godspell from the sounds of it.